Hello, I'd like to discuss some of the aspects of the kashrus of meat. There are many, many different issues that have to be dealt with when we talk about coming out with the final product of meat, which is kosher and may be eaten. First of all, we have to determine which of the many, many species in the world are kosher and which are forbidden completely. And no matter what's done, shrita or anything else, they could never be kosher. We're all familiar with some of the species which are more common. So those are the three kosher behemoths mentioned in the Torah. One being cattle, the other one sheep, and the third goats. So those are the only three kosher behemoths. Behemoths mean domesticated animals. There are many other domesticated animals, but they're all non-kosher. The farm animals, which you may be familiar with, donkeys and mules and horses, these are behemoths because they're domesticated. That means people can handle them and they keep coming back to people. They don't run away from people into the forest. They perform work for people. There are seven other species which are mentioned in the Torah specifically, and those are also kosher, but they're chayos. And there are many different halachas which result from their being considered a chaya, which we'll touch upon later. The Torah says specifically, Ayol utzvi v'yachmur, akoy v'dishoin usaoy v'zomer. Some of these we could identify positively. The species of deer, which has antlers, that's what the Torah calls Ayol. According to almost everyone, the common name that we use to identify deer, a tzvi, is actually an antelope or a gazelle, but the real deer is ayol. Whatever it is, some of these species were never really identified. One of the most interesting cases is the final one, where it says zomer, in the Greek translation of the Torah, which was made thousands of years ago, says on Zomer, Camelopardalus, which means a giraffe. And the giraffe has all the simonim of a kosher chaya. We don't know of anyone who eats giraffe today. But first we would like to discuss what are these simonim. What are the two characteristics that make a behemoth or a chaya kosher? The Torah says one is called maligera and the other one is called mafris parsa. Maligera means it chews its cud. Chewing the cud means that the behemoth or the chaya swallows a large quantity of grass, cellulose filled vegetation, which is impossible to digest completely as is. And this food is swallowed and it goes into a large stomach, which in English is called the rumen, and in Hebrew is called the keres. It sits there for a couple of days while it rots, and the little tiny microorganisms, chiefly bacteria, cause the rotting and the breaking down of the cellulose. After that, it goes into a second stomach called the Beis HaKoisos, the house of the cups, because the lining of this section, this stomach, is shaped like many, many little cups. And then that stomach squeezes it back into the food pipe, the esophagus or the veshet, as we call it in Hebrew, and from there it goes back to the mouth of the animal in little balls called geira, or in English, cud. It goes into the mouth of the animal, and the animal shifts these little balls of cud to its back teeth, which are heavy molars, and chews it back and forth and grinds it until it's liquefied, not completely, but pretty soft, and then the animal swallows it a second time. And this time it bypasses the first two stomachs and goes to a third, which is called the hemsith, and from there it goes into the fourth stomach, which is called the keva. The keva is called the abomasum, and the hemsith is called the omasum. There in the keva, it undergoes what ordinarily happens in the human single stomach, that is, that there's hydrochloric acid and some enzymes, pepsin and renin, and when the food is completely broken down and ready to be digested, it leaves the stomach and makes its travel through the intestines. Now, this whole process is called malei geira. It brings up those balls of cud into its mouth, and for a second chewing and a second swallowing, it's in the mouth for quite a while, and then it goes back down again, and it goes into the third and fourth stomach. The second simen that the kosher animal has is that it has mafris parso. It has hoofs on each of its legs. And each leg has two toes, which are like two separate hoofs. And the behemoth could step on different places. Its toes move independently of one another, and they function separately, like the fingers of a hand. And the split between the toes goes all the way up to the first joint, and that's like the root of the toes, which is a little bit higher, and that entire section has two separate organs. That's why it says in the Torah, "Shoisas shesas shtei perosos." It's split into two completely separate toes, independent of each other, shtei perosos. As long as these two simonim are present, one may eat a behemo or chayat. There are only seven general species of chayat, three species of behemo, and we haven't found any others that have these two characteristics. Chazal give us simonim to be able to recognize if we don't have the actual knowledge of the digestion of a behemoth. We find it in the desert. We could look at its mouth, the mouth of a kosher animal, of an animal that chews its cud, has a set of eight front teeth on its lower jaw with no opposing teeth on the upper jaw. The upper jaw is smooth and there are no other teeth. It's only in the back, after a large gap on either side, on the right and the left side, there's a gap with no teeth at all, and all the way in the back of its long mouth are the molars, four huge molars on top and on bottom, for each side a total of 16 teeth. These molars are used to make that second grinding, which is the chewing of the geira that has already been partially digested by the bacteria. Now, do we have to have a mesor? We have to have a tradition that says that this particular animal is kosher? It's the opinion of almost all poskim, to the degree that this is the minhag ha'olam and has always been, that any animal that has clearly the characteristics of being malei geira and mafris parso could be considered a kosher animal. If a species is found which is a little different, or a new world species perhaps, which was discovered, and it has these two, it chews its cud, and it has separate toes on, hoof toes on the bottom of its legs, then it may be eaten and it's a kosher animal. It doesn't present too much of a problem, this issue, simply because in all these hundreds and thousands of years we haven't discovered any really different strange species outside of the giraffe, which seems to have been well known all the way back in the time of the Targum HaShivim, which was before the time of the Tanoim and Amiroim. Targum HaShivim means the translation by 70 scholars from the Torah to Greek. When it comes to fish, well, that's easy because the two simonim are that they have to be scales and fins. Fins, we know what they are. They come out of the spine and the on the part of the fish, and they're like sails on a boat. Scales could be a little complex because scales means that there are plates like the scales that we're familiar with, but there are many variations in scales, and we'll leave that discussion for a special one devoted to fish. Birds are a lot different. Here the Torah doesn't give identifying characteristics called simonim. Over here by birds, the Torah gives a list. There are 21 birds which are listed by name, and by three of them it says Leminehu, Olaminoi, Olamino. That means that there are other species that are very similar to these which belong to the above species. Ace, Kol, Oirev, Leminehu. A crow or a raven has another bird which is similar to it, which is considered part of the extended species. Altogether, there are 24 species that are forbidden, and anything outside of these 24 species is mutter. It's allowed. The Alpi Halacha, there may be many hundreds of species of birds which we don't have any kosher tradition, but are actually kosher. And if someone would be alive today who would be familiar with all 24 species of birds that are forbidden, that are osir, so we would be able to clearly state at that time that all other birds are mutter. They may be eaten, and we would begin eating them. But we have no such person. The Chachamim, the Gemara, calls the Tzayet Chacham, a wise hunter, who's familiar with all the species of birds, and knows the 24 forbidden birds, he's not around today. And therefore, we cannot eat any bird today unless we know for a fact that it's kosher. But Chazal do give us four simonim. There are four identifying characteristics which appear in the kosher birds. If one has all four, then it stands to reason that we should be able to say it's kosher. Now, what are the four? One is that it has a zefek. A zefek is a crop. A crop is a little bag, a sack, at the base of the neck as the food pipe enters into the body. The food pipe is a straight, long tube that goes into the body till it goes to the back, where the digestion begins. But there's, in many birds, a small sack that could be filled with a large amount of food, which the bird holds there for storage, in wait for there to be some room in its digestive tract to be able to handle all the food that it nibbled upon. And so the zefik, or the crab, serves as a storage sack, where the bird could hold for a time when the food is not lying around, and yet it'll have all this extra food there fit to swallow, to push from that sack into its body. Not all kosher birds have a crop. A duck, for instance, has no crop. Yet it's a kosher bird. The Torah doesn't say it must have all four simonim. But if it has all four, then we could know that the bird is kosher. The second is kurkavonoi niklaf. Birds have, in the beginning of the digestive system, that is, after the food is swallowed and it passes through the long food pipe, it first goes into a muscular chamber where the food inside is squeezed and ground together. and all the pebbles and the seeds and everything else grind against each other as these muscles squeeze and relax and squeeze and relax, and they do the work of a powerful mill. So all these objects are ground against each other, and the seeds and other food is ground to a pulp, and even the stone is ground and it becomes a stony powder, which later in a female bird results in the shells of the eggs that the bird lays. Now, that is called in English a gizzard, and in Hebrew it's called a kurkavon. And inside there's a little sack in which the food goes, and outside of the sack is the muscular part of it, the meat. If the sack peels off easily, that's called kurkavon or niklaf, and it's one of the four characteristics of a kosher bird. Then, on the legs of the bird, there are toes. Not all birds have exposed toes. There are those that have webbed feet. But if there are toes on the bird, there are different arrangements for the toes. There are birds that have two on each side, and these are usually predatory birds which grab food with their toes and hold it tightly and dig into a victim. But the perching birds have a, sort of an opposing thumb in the back and three toes in the front. And there's something called a etzba yaseira, an extra toe. Some say that the word etzba yaseira means that single toe, which is like the thumb that grabs the perching stick from behind, from the side that's closer to the bird. And the other three are on the other side, so that one which opposes the three is called etzba yaseira. Some say it's those birds that have a longer toe. The middle of the three toes that oppose its thumb is much longer than the outer two. That's called etzba yaseira. The fourth, and this is the hardest to identify, ascertain, the fourth is that it's not a predatorial bird. It's not doires. The word doires could mean a number of things. It could be that it's a bird that grabs its prey in midair. It could be it's a bird that digs its claws into its victim and chokes it off and poisons it when it's ready to eat it. It could be it holds on to its food very tightly, and not like the other birds that nibble at their food when it lays on the ground. Either way, any of these three there is considered drisa. And if a bird has none of these, then it's a bird that's not doires. If it has a little sack inside the gizzard, kurkavon ei niklaf, if it could be peeled away, and it has a crap hanging from the base of its food pipe, and it has this etzba yaseira, meaning all the different characteristics that we spoke about, the opposing thumb or the longer middle one. If it has all these good simonim, it should be kosher. The hardest one to identify, as I said before, is that it's not doires, because it may be a bird that no one ever saw being doires. And yet, after 100 years, someone may suddenly observe this particular bird being doires and grabbing and holding on to its prey like the predatorial bird. And we're afraid that unless we have a tradition which clearly identifies this species as being permitted, then we can't take a chance and say that I observed this bird long enough and I know that it's not doires, because perhaps it really is. There are birds, though, that we could surely say that it's not doires, because if it has webbed feet, and there's no definition of doires which could possibly be attributed to this bird. As it is, the minig in most of Jewish communities throughout the world was always that when it comes to birds, we could only eat a bird which you could positively say that there's a tradition, that we know that it was accepted as a kosher bird. There are two different ways for a bird to be accepted as kosher. One is that in a certain large community in the world, all people, all members of that community, ate this bird for generations. That's considered to be sort of a national tradition, and it could be given over from generation to generation. It continues, and most of the birds that we eat fall into this category. The other Masorah is when you have this wise hunter who himself knows all the 24 forbidden birds and is able to clearly say that everyone but these 24, everyone outside of these 24, is a bird that's permitted. We don't have this second type of Masorah now at all, and we only have the first one, which is, if we could positively demonstrate that in a certain country or in a certain community, this bird was accepted and it wasn't questioned. There are cases where one country accepts a bird and has been doing so for generations, and another country doesn't. Could the people from the country that does not accept the tradition from the one that does accept this bird and begin now and use it as one of its acceptable kosher species? There's a difference of opinion, and therefore we cannot really accept a bird unless this particular community had a tradition saying that it's a kosher bird. So because of that, there are certain birds that are accepted to certain communities. For instance, the guinea hen, which is a valuable bird as far as food goes, and it's easily domesticated. And in certain communities, like in Algeria and others, they were widely accepted. And yet in Europe, the guinea hen wasn't accepted because, despite the fact that the guinea hen rather lived there and was easily bred there and was known to the European communities. So that's an example of a question of whether the tradition of one country could be acceptable to the other. There are many, many examples of these, but the common birds that we all have, species of chicken, hens and roosters, of course, and all members of that chicken family, many species of duck and geese and pigeons and doves and quail are considered traditionally acceptable because they're species that have been used throughout the world for many generations. Once in a while, do you find that an issue is made over a species that just was discovered? And some say that it's a new species, and why should we consider it to be something that is acceptable? Perhaps that's not so. This is a major issue when it comes to birds. The one exception to the Masorah, the tradition which is necessary for birds, is one of the most popular food birds of all, and that's a turkey. The turkey is a New World bird, and it never was found in the Old World, and there's clearly no Masorah. At the time the turkey was discovered and it was introduced to the Old World, people thought that it was an Indian bird, or a Turkish bird, or a Chinese bird, or perhaps a bird from Eretz Yisrael, and it was rumored and widespread that the communities mentioned before accepted that bird traditionally, and therefore we all could. And it's not considered a bird that has only a tradition in one country, because it's not a problem if all other countries never saw this bird before. If they would have seen it, they would have accepted it, and therefore it's considered an international tradition right away. When it was discovered later that the turkey was completely New World bird. And there isn't a single species in the Old World that's even similar to a turkey. So the problem resurfaced, and people began to say, well, then how could we eat a turkey? It has no Messiah, it has no tradition, it's a New World bird, and it doesn't come from all these places that it was rumored to come. There's a lot of literature which is used to explain why the turkey was accepted, perhaps because it was already eaten for so many years before it was clearly proven that it was a New World species. Maybe that's why it's acceptable. Perhaps because after these hundreds of years of observing turkeys, we found that even not in one case was a turkey observed to be doyres in any of the definitions of doyres that we used before. So perhaps because of that, the turkey is accepted. After all, it does have a crop, and it has a pilot away gizzard, and it has the extra toe. And as far as the being doyres, of the millions of turkeys that were observed, not one was found to be doyres. I thought that perhaps there could be an additional reason. Chazal say that, as I mentioned earlier, and that's the halacha in Shulchan Aruch, that if you have a rabbi tzayud, you have an expert hunter who knows all 24 forbidden species, so then he has the right to say that everything else, whether he ever saw it before or not, is considered mutter, is permitted. And what this does teach us is that all 24 forbidden birds were Old World birds, because if any of these species were birds that are only found in the world, there couldn't have ever been a wise hunter who was familiar with all 24 birds, because those that weren't around in the Old World, that is the Eastern Hemisphere, couldn't possibly be known to the Rabbi Tzayed, to the wise and teacher hunter. And Al Korchach, all 24 birds are Old World birds. The only species of New World bird that has absolutely no relationship and no parallel to any Old World species is the turkey. It can't really be considered Laminoi, Laminehu, to any of the birds in the Old World. Now, some people claim that the turkey is some form of a chicken, a deviant form of a chicken, but that's hardly possible because there are so many characteristics in a chicken that's completely different from those of a turkey. If you ever notice, the neck of a chicken is completely covered with down, small feathers, and larger feathers, and the turkey has no feathers at all on the neck. The head and features of the head are all different than those of a chicken, and some of the internal features as well. So there's no question at all that turkey is a species all of its own. And if it's not a subspecies of an Old World bird, then it's surely not one of the 24 forbidden birds, and the consequence must be mutter, because meaning permitted, which was a system that had been used and is permissible al pi halacha to identify a bird as being kosher simply by knowing that it's not one of the 24 that are forbidden. Now, after we have the species clearly identified, there's quite a bit more that has to be done before the animal, a bird, becomes kosher. There's shrita, there's all the halachas associated with shrita. Nikur, which means removing forbidden parts, and bedikas v'treifas, and getting rid of the blood, the forbidden fats. All these are requirements which must be performed before the bird is ready for eating, and we'll reserve the next discussion for some of these topics. Thank you, Avraham Purim, and a good year.